Is privacy a crime? If you look at the way the government's been treating some of these crypto privacy tools, you would think so. But typically, as usual, the nuance, there's all these details in the middle to describe what's really going on. And so I wanted to bring on someone who could really help me understand this Samurai situation, Tornado Cash, and all of this. So I brought on a crypto lawyer, Orlando Cosme, to break it down for us. But first, welcome back to Built on Bitcoin. I'm your host, Jacob Brown. And you know what we do here? We're talking to the best founders building on Bitcoin. And that's what we do today. So this one's interesting because Orlando is originally a lawyer. And then he started a Bitcoin startup trying to build tech to make it easy to launch a regulatory compliant DAO. That ultimately didn't work, so now he's back in action as a crypto lawyer advising for tech startups. So he has an excellent POV on both sides of the landscape and is watching all this stuff unfold and trying to help his companies navigate the space. So we go over what is going on with this Samurai situation and Tornado Cash, which are similar, but there is some interesting pieces in the weeds. What does this mean for things like building custodial versus non-custodial? What legal precedents could be set here? Is the government overreaching? What should a founder be doing in these scenarios? And a bunch of other topics. So this one was fantastic. Always good to catch up with Orlando. So without further ado, let's jump into this podcast with Orlando Cosme, the founder and crypto lawyer at OC Advisory.
Welcome to Built on Bitcoin.
Orlando, what's up, my man? How are you?
Great, man. Great to be back on the podcast. Dude, been a while.
Good to have you, man. Good to have you. Yeah, bro. No easy warm up here. Let's just jump straight in the deep end. It's been a crazy week. We had highs of the halving and like the Runes launch, and then the lows of the government coming after more crypto stuff. So, give us the overview from your view of the Samurai situation. And as we were talking off the call, like it sounds like it ties in pretty closely with some of this Tornado Cash stuff from a year or two ago. So, yeah, give us the lay of the land, then we can dive deeper.
Yeah, I guess I'll start off with, I think, like my high-level takeaway. Also, just as an intro, I'm a crypto lawyer. I currently run my own crypto-focused law firm. So I represent tons of early-stage crypto startups, as well as some VC funds and corporate regulatory counseling. So basically helping them to kind of develop and structure products, basically to help make sure that some of the things that happened this week don't happen to them. And so, you know, kind of what's been happening the past week, I think the broad level takeaway is that the government doesn't really care whether or not what you're providing is actually non-custodial, or if the app or project you have doesn't actually control user funds. And I think that is very important. And I think that's like a very key takeaway here and concern, because, you know, I think the general impression, including among lots of crypto lawyers, including among myself, frankly, or by myself, was that as long as, you know, whatever product you're offering, whether it be like a wallet, whether it be some kind of DApp, et cetera, doesn't have access to user keys and therefore just, you know, can't actually control user funds. Because at the end of the day, then all of those transactions are user initiated and generated. Then they are not what are called money transmitters. And just taking a step back, a money transmitter is something that basically is in the business of transferring funds on behalf of users. It is basically part of this law called the Bank Secrecy Act, which is kind of basically like the KYC Act. And if you are a money transmitter, you have to register your business with a federal agency called FinCEN, or the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, as well as basically every single state that you operate in. There are some exceptions with some states where it's not required, but like you could think of like most states. And if you are a money transmitter as part of these laws, you have to have a pretty robust KYC program. You have to KYC every user. You have to like do due diligence, et cetera. You know, all those fun things that everyone loves to do when they sign up for like Coinbase or a bank, et cetera. And, you know, for the longest time, again, there was this impression that as long as you didn't hold user funds that, control user funds, that you would kind of be excluded from being a money transmitter. And one of the big reasons for that is actually FinCEN, which does civil enforcement of the Bank Secrecy Act, actually laid out some guidance in 2019 applied specifically to crypto. And in it, they go through a lot of different types of use cases, including privacy mixers, which we're about to get into, as well as multi-sig wallets. I think they go through a DEX. And they basically kind of go through the scenarios, not like every scenario. Frankly, it could probably be way more helpful. I wish it was way more helpful as a lawyer that's then like kind of use this to then counsel my clients. But it goes through a decent amount of scenarios. It kind of shows, okay, would this be a money transmitter under the BSA, under our regulations, and under this guidance, and under our opinion, or would it not be? And the kind of through line, they don't actually say this explicitly, but you know, if you could just connect the dots, which is what lawyers do, the through line through the whole thing is basically like, if you just don't have control over user funds, aka you like just don't have their private keys, or in the case of if you're like, let's say like a multi-sig, if you're providing a multi-sig kind of service, if you can't unilaterally move user funds, so maybe you have control over one signature and like a two or three multi-sig, but you can't, you know, you don't have two or three, right? Then you would not be a money transmitter. Okay. And so that was kind of, so that was 2019, and that was kind of the, I don't want to say lay of the land, but kind of the general impression that I think the whole industry had. So now fast forward to sometime in 2023, I think it was during the summer, I don't remember the exact time, the federal government, specifically the Department of Justice, ends up indicting the Tornado Cash founders, arguing that Tornado Cash was a money transmitter. Well, how could this be, right? Like, the Tornado Cash was run on smart contracts. In fact, they were immutable. And in the indictment where the government has these allegations, they actually specifically say that they made the smart contract, the protocol, immutable. So literally the founders, it was a situation where they were like, you know, dynos or decentralized in name only. They actually had, there were no admin keys or anything. There was actually like no sort of control over this protocol. And so that seems to pretty squarely conflict with FinCEN's 2019 guidance. And, you know, I know this seems very like how could that be? You know, I think some people may wonder how, like, how is that possible, right? It seems like they're kind of doing something illegal. But actually, the Department of Justice doesn't really have to abide by FinCEN guidance. So the Department of Justice is a different agency, and the Department of Justice does criminal enforcement. FinCEN does regulations and civil enforcement. Right. And so basically FinCEN kind of does the things that don't put you in jail, whereas Department of Justice is kind of all about a focus on actual criminal enforcement. Right. This the really scary stuff. And unfortunately, this is where the surprise came from on like the criminal side of things. And then so that occurred. And then fast forward to this past week and you had Samurai, which was another privacy mixing service. Also, an indictment came out, indicting the founders, kind of similar situation. The facts were different. The way, the protocols kind of worked were different. Samurai, dealt with Bitcoin. And so naturally, obviously Bitcoin doesn't have, the kind of same fully expressive smart contracts, at least not native to, the actual Bitcoin protocol itself as, Ethereum does. And so Tornado Cash on Ethereum, Samurai kind of dealing with figuring out a solution for Bitcoin, but similar situation where Samurai, and even in the indictment itself literally concedes that no Samurai employees had access to user private keys. So again, not alleging that they had control of user funds. And so I think this was kind of what put the industry on notice. And I think, you know, I don't want to like display or like kind of belittle the kind of privacy concerns, because I think that is a major issue. At the heart of this, right, the reason why this is happening is because, unfortunately, I think this is true. I don't know the exact percentages. It's hard, probably hard to verify, but obviously there are some illicit actors, of course, kind of using these privacy mixing services, right? Whether it be North Korea, Iran, or like sanctioned Russian oligarchs, people do use them to launder money. Even, you know, exploits, right? Protocol exploits. We have seen this. We've seen wallets kind of go through these protocols, right? And the government doesn't like this. Like, let's be, you know, let's be real here. This is at the core of the issue, right? They don't want these, what they have determined to be bad people, then like hiding their money and being able to then kind of enjoy the fruits of what they consider to be illicit, like a kind of proceeds, right? And so that's what's really going on here. But in the process, in making these arguments, both this indictment, both of these indictments, and then on Friday, in a brief that they that Department of Justice filed against the Tornado Cash founders, specifically making the arguments as to why Tornado Cash is a money transmitter, they actually kind of go much broader than privacy mixers. They basically say, they basically kind of lay out the structure of how, frankly, many dApps and on-chain operators may end up being money transmitter without necessarily having to take custody or control of user funds. And I think it's pretty concerning for the rest of the industry, because I think potentially a lot of other projects may be currently doing a lot of these things or similar things that the government has alleged helps make a product a money transmitter. And so I can get into that in a sec. I know that was a very long kind of intro explanation, but there's a lot of kind of background here. But that's kind of what shook, I think, out of the industry this week, is that it kind of seems like a lot of, you know, these services, and by services, I mean even like network, basic network services that dApps might be providing to users, the government might be alleging is actually a money transmitter, and therefore you need to KYC everyone, you need to register, and this kind of like permissionless, you know, kind of idea, all right, this idea that, you know, you can have a kind of permissionless app as long as you don't have control of user funds, and that's okay. You know, it may be like the government is taking a different position from that, which kind of strikes at the core of all crypto, right? Because it kind of makes permissionless and self-custodial applications, including wallets, dApps, etc., potentially impossible.
Got it. Yeah, it's interesting because the non-custodial piece was definitely what the thing that I've heard the longest is, like, if you're gonna go custodial, lean into the regulations, go see, you know, Uncle Gary. If you're gonna build it non-custodial, you're mostly safe. And now that's changing a lot. Is the thing that's changed that, so are they bringing it down to what the service provides and less about how the funds are moving through this pipeline? Is that the way to think about it?
So I would say practically, potentially, right? But potentially isn't really good for legal purposes, right? If you are a builder and you're trying to build an app and it's like, well, maybe they won't go after me because I'm not building a privacy mixer. And the issue is that the arguments, the kind of the legal framework and theory that they're trying to push forward here can easily be applied to all sorts of use cases, not just privacy mixers, which is a concern, right? Like if the way they're making their argument as to how Tornado Cash and Samurai were money transmitters were specific to privacy mixers, that would still be a major issue, of course. I'm not trying to downplay that at all, but it would at least be cabined into like that specific use case. But those arguments, that the basis they're relying on, is not limited to that. It really can be used all across the board. And it's more, as you related to, it's kind of more focused on what I would call services around providing infrastructure. Yeah. And the reason why I say services is because legally, the way the government view, or like the way the law views a lot of things what you would consider software, right? They actually view it as services if it's provided on like a cloud basis, right? So like any kind of like this like app you're using on your phone, like on a browser, right? If you don't download the software, right, then it's considered a service that they're actually providing you. And I think that's part of the issue, is that there are a lot more protections for infrastructure and like payment systems, that those payment systems may not be money transmitters, but it's when you get to the services where they start to kind of really focus on what you're doing. And so that's kind of the concern. And I can get maybe a little more specific into like what specific services the government was looking at here. But like, and again, I don't know if that'd be helpful, but it is pretty much very much in the weeds. But yeah, so that's kind of, again, it's much more broader than just the kind of use cases here.
Got it. And then, yeah, so I kind of want to steel man the government's position, because the crypto people are like,
We want to build non-custodial. We want to build unstoppable DeFi. We're trying to remake the financial system in like a parallel system. Like all those, they have their goals. The government has its own goals. And, you know, trying to stop terrorism, for example, is a good goal. Most people, if you kind of put away your kind of like the extreme ideology, it's a good goal to have. It's hard to tell who's tracking what and who is actually bad is obviously a definitional thing. But when we're looking at like, let's assume stopping terrorism and bad people from transacting is a good goal. The way they're doing it now sounds like they're doing it with a broad brush and it's painting over way too many things. So they're kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater in some sense. How, I don't know if the question is like, how do they do this properly? Or is this just kind of the hard thing of hard things of dealing with crypto because of the way it works?
Yeah, I guess first, you know, your first point about like just kind of stealing this argument. No, you are right. And I think, you know, a lot of people would be hard pressed to say like, yeah, I don't know, like certain actors probably shouldn't be able to kind of just launder money, right? I think the issue here is beyond even like whether something's good or bad is, you know, you have this law on the books, right? And just if I could quickly like steal man the government's argument, I think what they would say is, you know, we never technically said that control is necessary, right? Though, this is my own opinion, like one element that's required is that you accept user funds. I don't really know how you can accept something if you can't control it. Like if something just kind of goes by, you know, et cetera. But the government says, and they literally say this in the Tornado Cash brief, is, you know, you can't just like create this like immutable protocol and then provide these kind of affiliated services around it. So here, Tornado Cash was helping to kind of run this relayer. They would kind of, through their UI, a user, and basically to help to kind of basically improve the anonymity of the transactions, a user could, if they wanted to, basically like go through this relayer kind of function. And from there, the actual front end, so this is what the founders actually built, would help to kind of weigh which relayer would be chosen to go ahead and do that, right? And the relayer would then it would basically publish transaction on behalf of the user and actually pay gas on behalf of the user, right? And then in doing so, basically they would have to pay some TORN, which is the Tornado Cash token. And long story short, right, like the idea is that they would almost also like the Tornado Cash founders, because they held a lot of TORN, a lot of the token, their tokens would kind of appreciate as like more of this service is being used, because it created a use case for the token. So they're basically getting paid to create this service where you had these relayers kind of publishing transactions on behalf of users to make it more private and paying their gas on behalf of their users. And the government's basically saying like, look, they're providing all of these services, right? Even though they technically didn't have the private key, access to private keys, so then technically, you know, provide have control of user funds. You know, we can't just like let them do this complete runaround around the money transmitter laws, right? And allow, you know, like basically now, like Russia, whoever else, you know, like North Korea, whoever else we deem to be an illicit actor, to just like be able to move money through impunity through these systems, even though you're still providing these heavy kind of services and usages, right? Or like these heavy services around the system that are pretty critical to how it functions. And so that's kind of the government's argument, their stealing, right? They like basically can just run around these laws in that way. And I would argue, well, okay, so then Congress should rewrite the laws then, right? Because that is the law. And you kind of write the whole, like I'm in the business of like providing guidance. You can't just like try to rug everyone on the law because you don't like it, right? The law is a law, and you kind of need to still be able to accept user funds if you're in the business of being a money transmitter. And in my opinion, like you can't really accept something without having control of it, right? So that's kind of the steel man there. In terms of guidance to users, you know, it's tough, right? I actually just had a call with someone earlier today about this, you know, and maybe I think if we catch up in 6 months, I'll have a completely different answer. Unfortunately, a lot of lawyers were relying on that 2019 guidance, right? And I think what happened this past week with Samurai and the Tornado Cash government motion to dismiss brief is kind of threw a bomb on what everyone thought, like, you know, what we could rely on for guidance. And so frankly, you know, and I hate saying this, but this is the reality of operating crypto, is there's a tremendous, the amount of uncertainty around money transmission laws, I think, just increased, you know, by a major factor in terms of how they apply to crypto projects. You know, I will say, I think practically speaking, a lot of, there are a lot of apps, a lot of builders that are, you know, doing things where they're providing these kind of ancillary services around their dApps, right? And, you know, they're not, I don't think everyone's going to end up being indicted, just like practically speaking, right? I also think this is a very aggressive view of the law. It could be the court ends up striking it down. And I know a lot of lawyers, frankly, disagree with the government's position here. The issue is that, well, you still were indicted, and like these people are potentially sitting in jail. They have this like potential crazy sentence hanging over their head if they lose. So it may be that this might end up getting like pled out in the future or something. I'm not sure. And so if that ends up happening, then you won't really see a solid resolution. And so it makes the situation like very tough, I think, to provide accurate guidance. That being said, I do think there are some nuggets here. I think, and the way I would think about this is a more probability-based approach. And also, you know, quick aside, nothing here is legal advice. I'm not your lawyer. If you have questions about your facts and circumstances, this is highly fact and circumstance dependent. It really depends on the specific project. Like, you really can't go off of like anything I say and just try to build your whole thing off of that and think you're going to be fine. Very fact and circumstance dependent. So please like go to your attorney. Because one small fact that you may not think is important, or that I might neglect to say here, could have a huge impact on the analysis for your specific project. But I think, you know, some things that we can kind of say are probably lower risk here, right? And is, I think, the way to think about it, it's frankly, you're taking risk no matter what, because it's just that much of a gray area. There's no clear cut rules now. But I think what's lower risk is a situation where maybe you run a UI, right? You're not running any underlying infrastructure, right? So you may have some kind of immutable smart contracts. Actually, you know, maybe like go through the stack. Or maybe like go through a stack and go through like lower risk things, right? I'm also going to put a pause on like some Bitcoin stuff, because I think Bitcoin stuff, and I'll get back to it in a sec. It's like, obviously there are smart contracts, so things are a little different. And I think a little higher risk, because since there aren't smart contracts, you have to kind of do things in a more, you have to basically do more stuff essentially to provide a good UX. So let's take like the more sort of smart contract platform, right? First off, that smart contract, right? Lowest risk thing would be for it to be completely immutable. And as in, is that a situation where the founders or anyone else kind of has some sort of admin keys that they can then upgrade the contract? That's probably, again, low risk. And the idea in the reason here is because there isn't anyone who can say that, again, kind of have any sort of control or be transmitting the funds. Even though the DOJ and they're kind of ultimately disagreeing with this view, I still think it's still pretty like a lower risk fact, right? And then moving on up, right? If you do have some sort of admin rights, right, having that admin rights kind of be done or be held by maybe like a much larger diffuse group of people. And again, I just want to provide this warning, you know, the government, again, in the Tornado Cash case, still kind of disagree with that view. But I still think generally it's a good fact. It's a better fact than, let's say, having admin keys where you can just frankly upgrade the protocol. And the reason for that is because you can just rug someone, right? If you think about it,
and just to be clear, when you say admin for the developer, it might mean upgradability. So immutability means I post the contract the way it's constructed.
That's it. Impossible to change.
Integrate. Yeah. There's an in-out process. The upgrading thing is you can change something in that process that is not you can change some function in the middle or upgrade the contract. That's one step up for what you're saying.
Yeah, I would say if you can change it, right, I think you just enter a world of higher risk, I would say.
Yep. Okay.
Right. And of course, you know, frankly, practically speaking, a lot of teams, especially in the beginning of their life cycles and the beginning of the protocols, frankly, will make the decision to kind of maybe assume some of that risk, just because there's also a major risk to not being able to upgrade a protocol. Because if you're building a kind of new frontier protocol, right, there may be exploits that even with the best auditors and the best team, you don't catch. So that is a risk. That is like a kind of like judgment call that teams need to make. But that's just like starting in the base level, right? Like, okay, what can you do? Like, so I am not potentially, to lower my risk of getting caught under these laws. I think that's like probably point number one, right? As you move up the stack, right? So maybe getting away from the smart contracts and even maybe I think another thing I would, and it actually isn't moving up the stack, but kind of similarly in that infrastructure level, I would also be very careful of running in underlying infrastructure if you are also running an app. And so what I mean by underlying infrastructure is if you are, let's say, if you run, let's say, like a kind of, I don't know, like a staking, like a liquid staking app, let's say, right? And you have like the UI, right? The application for a liquid staking app. I would probably not also be a party in that like liquid staking protocol that's also staking on behalf of users. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I think like disintermediate or like separating underlying infrastructure with kind of like the more top layer app level is also pretty important for your risk. I won't get into kind of exactly why, because it'll be a very long explanation. I kind of just move on to different points to be helpful. But another, I would say, like major piece of advice. So point number two. Point number three, so then now moving up to the actual apps themselves. I would say the lowest risk thing you can do in terms of like actually running the app is, you know, providing data from the chain. So kind of like indexing and providing like the actual data from the chain that then allow, and maybe creating a transaction for a user that then allows the user using their own private keys to sign a transaction. And usually what ends up happening, right? Like just functionally speaking, most apps run their own node and they will broadcast the transaction for the users because it's a lot simple, it's a lot faster, et cetera, right? So that's probably the lowest risk thing you can do. As soon as you start doing things, like I know a lot of order books may do this, for example, you start running like algos to start like matchmaking outside of just providing a simple transaction, broadcasting that transaction on your UI, that's when you start running into much higher risk. Or like in the privacy context, right? We see this with Samurai and with Tornado Cash, right? They're basically providing these other kind of services on top that helped kind of anonymize a lot of these transactions, anonymize the wallets that eventually these assets would go to, right? So in Tornado Cash, again, they were running this kind of like relayer service, and then their UI on top of that was helping to kind of weigh and kind of choose which relayer would end up would have been kind of connected with that specific transaction. And then in the case of Samurai, Samurai had this like centralized coordinator server, at least as alleged in the indictment. I know some of these facts I've heard kind of incorrect, but you kind of have to go by the government's indictment, at least at this stage of the case. So I'm just going to read off the indictment right here. Samurai's coordinator service randomly selects four other inputs already in a selected pool to be mixed with the new incoming input and communicates that information to each user. So basically, it kind of like helps to kind of structure the transaction and create kind of links. Basically, what the government's getting at is here, Samurai basically created at a server that kind of helped to kind of link information between different parties that were then going to like submit transactions, and that helped to kind of anonymize the service, right? Or anonymize the transactions. And so in adding that extra kind of service on top, at least in the government's theory, is what kind of made this a money service business and made it a money transmitter service without necessarily controlling user funds. So I think the other thing to kind of be very careful of is providing something like this on top of your UI that is really kind of separate from the underlying network, separate from the actual blockchain itself. It's kind of actually adding this extra feature, which I think is tough because I think that's how a lot of, I think, projects try to differentiate themselves in this market, because given that a lot of things are open source, everyone's trying to think of a moat, and a lot of projects are like, okay, I can do this thing off chain, right? And provide this service off chain, and then it kind of mixes in with the on-chain transaction, right? And now we have this moat because the off-chain stuff is proprietary, right? We're using maybe AI or whatever. We have like this great AI team, et cetera. I would say now those types of projects are a lot higher risk, kind of proceeding from the Samurai indictment and the government's arguments in the Tornado Cash case.
Got it. And speaking of the money transmitter thing, because it seems like a lot of things fit in that definition now, especially on totally. The payment. Especially on the payment side. So at least from what we've seen from the government, is privacy like a an additional layer where it's like if you stack both, you're kind of, they're treating privacy or wanting to track or control as a very high risk or concerning behavior versus just payments. Like, do we have precedent that payments tech that hasn't been regulatorily clear also gone after, or is it just the privacy and payment side that's been like
so
currently?
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, the government has definitely gone after money transmission outside of privacy in the context of crypto. That's what Arthur Hayes got indicted for and charged with. I think he had pled guilty, and that was for running an exchange that was an unlicensed money transmitter, and he ended up having like U.S. customers, etc. And if you think of what an exchange does, that is money transmission, and it's actually that is how Circle and Kraken, Coinbase, that's how they're actually regulated currently. They're all money transmitters. They have all their licenses, so that's why when you create a Coinbase account, you KYC. They are money transmitters, but they're registered and they're licensed. The government doesn't, it's not like specific to privacy. I do think, I think there's a difference between what the government thinks is substantive law, which again, if you go off of their arguments, it's like a lot of potentially like on-chain, just like apps that kind of function on-chain, right? Because they are going after this like idea that even if you don't control user funds, as long as you provide this like very important service in the transmit that's like involved in the transmission of user funds, and again, they don't really have a limiting principle or kind of a way to cabin what that service is, because why would they do that? But that's kind of their theory here. Then you are a money transmitter, but I think that is very, so that's a substantive law. At least what the government, I think the theory that they're putting forward is substantive law. There's a difference though between that and how likely is a government to go after you and press criminal charges, for something that you're doing. And this is like to my point in the beginning of the call, that because you did have a lot of, frankly, like illicit actors use these privacy mixing services, the government really didn't like that, right? So they just, as a practical matter, they went after them. And so it could be that there's like an unwritten rule where like, okay, if you're not doing something, if you're just like, if you're running a DEX or if you're running some other kind of products, like other kind of protocol, that the government won't actually go after you, at least in terms of criminal charges, because you're not running something where it's like, that like the government is, that illicit actors are using this to launder money. And if you look at the Samurai indictment, there are some pretty damning tweets from the team, like kind of almost poking fun at the fact that like Russian oligarchs are like laundering money through Samurai. And it's just like, dude, why are you doing that? Right? Like, why are you saying that? Right? You're kind of just asking for it at that point. And that's kind of what I mean in that, like, there's a substantive law issue, right? And I think, me as a lawyer, when I'm counseling clients, I always have to like remind them of that. Like, hey, if you do something here where there's a lot of risk from a substantive law standpoint, you're kind of at the government's mercy to not potentially press charges against you, right? But that being said, the practical reality is that they may, like, the unwritten law here or unwritten rule here might be that really, and I think this is kind of my intuition. I think the government is really just interested in like going after these services that like, or that they view as a very serious national security threat. And because, they had good authority that a lot of these illicit actors were using these privacy mixers to basically launder money and get their money around or evade sanctions, they feel like they had to do something about it. From like, again, my own legal, like my own point of view, my own opinion, not legal advice, I think the government's arguments in the Tornado Cash response to the motion to dismiss there, frankly, I think some of their arguments are legally weak and deficient. And I think like some of it might get struck down, but I don't think the government cares, right? Because the government at the end of the day, they succeeded in their goal, which is like, no one's using Samurai or Tornado Cash anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what they want, right? Like at the end of the day, what they care about isn't like, I think necessarily like, crypto or whatever. I mean, they might have some other views on crypto. I don't want to say that they don't care about crypto, but here specifically what they care about is illicit actors, North Korea, Iran, Russian oligarchs using these privacy mixer services, and they just want to shut it down immediately. Yep. And that's what they did, right? So to your point, like I think it's not official, and substantively their position is a lot broader, but it might be like an unwritten kind of rule.
Yeah, this point I've heard online, I've heard both takes, both sides of like the Samurai guys were very inflammatory, if you will, in some of their marketing. And some people will be free speech absolutists, like they should go under the free speech, you know, thing. And it's not, they're not called, show us someone who actually used it in that way. I'm kind of in the middle where it's like, you're playing with fire there. Like, why are you doing that, bro? It's kind of stupid. But that's a side point. I just want to call that out. Like, that's an interesting nuance.
Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't think about it this way. Like, I don't get me wrong. I'm sympathetic to the First Amendment, like, position and argument. But also, like, just imagine a jury trial, right? Like, if you're kind of making, like, the prosecution's job pretty easy. And, like, a major element here is going to be intent, right? Did they know that Samurai was being used to, like, launder money, you know, or, you know, to do something illegal or whatever? And it's like, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, look at this tweet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
You're just kind of making it easy for everyone. Right. And so, and it's just also, you know, trials are about stories. Right. And they're going to come in. I already see the trial now. The government's going to come in and be like, you know, this is about like protecting our government from like terrorists and illicit actors, whatever. And in fact, you're going to hear about a tweet where the founder said, you know, they're actually encouraging illicit actors to use their, you know, whatever. And now you're priming the jury. To be like, okay, these people are like the creative thing to just like do illegal stuff, right? And so regardless of like the technical kind of actual law, right, it's like you're already primed to be like, these people are just don't care about doing illegal stuff, and may probably wanted it because they helped them to make money or something, right? And you know, like, people are human, they're gonna go off of like these good narratives, and it creates an easy narrative. So regardless of like whether the First Amendment free speech issues, right, it's just like, obviously just don't be dumb. You know?
Yeah, totally. Touch the stove, you're going to get burned. All right, going back for a sec on, so you mentioned that FinCEN gave some guidance in 2019. The DOJ doesn't have to follow that. And your kind of case was, if you want to go against something like that, rewrite the law, give us clarity. So with these cases, and maybe from a legal point of view, what do we hope gets clarity in these things? Like, what's ultimately being kind of like debated here, and what's likely to be on the other side of these cases, good or bad, that gives us regulatory clarity?
Yeah, I would say, so unfortunately the government's position was so broad, and their arguments in the Tornado Cash indictment and Samurai, that like, frankly, if some of these theories get upheld, it's gonna be really bad. I think very bad precedent. Like I said, from a substantive law standpoint. And I mean, don't get me wrong, this is a trial level case. So no rulings here are technically precedent, though they are persuasive. But if they get appealed, and on an appeal, it goes to an appellate court, the appellate court decides appeals, and those are the courts that create precedent. And it's legally binding precedent. You know, I hate the saying, because it's so, it's a little bit, it is a cliche, but there's a saying like, bad facts create bad law. And again, as I was saying before, with like just the egging on of like the illicit actors, et cetera, my concern here is basically, I think the worst case scenario here is that there's eventually an appeal, and that appeal goes to the appellate court. And given the facts involved, right, because the appellate court, again, they're going to try to like stick to what's the law, but then they're also going to, you know, people are human at the end of the day. Judges are still human. They may try to call balls and strikes, but they're human. They might see this thing and it's like, I mean, look at these tweets, right? It cannot be that we like allow this thing to kind of stand, because imagine that's just going to open the floodgates, right? And this is a national security threat, and courts, Congress, the entire government tends to be very sympathetic to national security arguments and authority, and tend to also give a lot of deference to the government when it comes to national security. And so my concern is that basically in doing so, right, given the government's current theory of kind of like money transmitter laws, that there ends up being this precedent, this legally binding precedent, that essentially if you just provide some kind of ancillary service around like some kind of crypto transaction, even if you don't have control or possession of user funds, that you are a money transmitter. And I think the worst case scenario there is basically every single on-chain app would be a money transmitter. Which I think like that kind of just destroys all of crypto. Now, destroy permissionlessness. The only way anyone could operate within the like with any US users legally would be if they KYC every user. Again, it would just really destroy all of what kind of like crypto and Bitcoin was meant to kind of create, right? The freedom to transact. And unless you're like a dev and you can kind of just go through the back end and create your own kind of transaction through your own like node, and like most users can't do that. It's just gonna make sure that like crypto is this very confined small little thing. I think that's like the worst case scenario, and that's kind of like my biggest fear after seeing everything that's happened here. I think the best case scenario is that a court is just like, this is way too extreme, because frankly the same arguments made by the government can apply to a lot of non-crypto stuff, can apply to a lot of fintech apps, right? Because think about like all the amount of this like periphery kind of services people that are provided on the internet, right, in connection with payments, right? A lot of those actors then can be money transmitters. So this is not confined to crypto, luckily. And so I think it's going to be pretty important for the industry to kind of get these other actors on board, both in like traditional finance, both in fintech, and kind of bring them on board to this case, because this case is broader than crypto. And I think, you know, again, I mentioned this before, but my view here is that the government went too far in a lot of places. And I think the best case scenario is a lot of that gets struck down and a court will end up kind of ruling that, to be a money transmitter, you need to accept user funds. You can't be a money transmitter if you don't accept user funds. Like if you just send money to me, right, in my mailbox, right, and, you know, I don't know, it gets like automatically forwarded or something, you get the wrong, I don't know, like you just send money to me, right? Like I'm not a money transmitter now, because then I take this money, like I'm like, or I see the money, right? Like I didn't mean to get this money. Like, why are you sending this to me? You need to kind of accept something. You need to have control of it. You need to, there's like a specific kind of definition here as to what accept means, and it usually means controlling something. And so I'm hoping that that's kind of where the court goes. It ends up ruling that, you know, you actually do need to control user funds, because then I think we can go back to kind of relying on, okay, if you're non-custodial, if you don't control user funds, you are good to go here. And I think that's actually pretty good, right? I think it's a pretty good outcome for the industry because it will then incentivize more kind of like these non-custodial arrangements, right? Like the whole idea of crypto, of Bitcoin, is, you know, not your keys on your coin, right? Like you should be in control, in custody of your own funds, and no one else should be. No service that you use, no app that you use should be in control of your funds. So I think that will actually incentivize kind of like best practices in the industry.
Yep. Love it. Okay. Two more last questions as we close out. One that came on Twitter was, ZK technology is getting better. Is leveraging things like ZK at a deep level give some protection here? Too early to say. What's your stance on this?
So I would say if the government's theory ends up holding up, no. Because, I mean, literally, Tornado Cash used ZK proofs. That was like part of the service that they were kind of using. And the government literally, I think there's a line, if I remember correctly in the brief, where they say something like, literally just because, like quote, it's like, just because Tornado Cash was using ZK proofs doesn't mean they can get around being money transmitters. And I think to my point, you know, as I was saying before, right, of having like a UI or some kind of side service that's really providing very important critical services to the protocol, I think providing some kind of ZK proof arrangement, right, structure protocol, like in connection with these like transactions, is exactly the kind of side services, right, auxiliary services or ancillary services that the government's basically saying like makes you a money transmitter. So I don't think, I mean, you know, devil's in the details, of course, so it kind of would depend. Like I know there's a lot of, and you know, I represent certain clients that are doing this, like I know there was a lot of kind of like these almost like broad, the centralized ZK kind of prover networks that are kind of being built out now. So, you know, would that potentially, like, would that be helpful? It would really depend on the details, but I think generally what the government's saying here is that's exactly the kind of thing that we're saying makes you a money transmitter, even if you don't control user funds.
Okay. And then what about, and I'm sure this is case by case, but any broad guidance on where to incorporate, or should you even be in the U.S. right now if you don't have to be, kind of guidance for a founder who's building this stuff?
Sure. Yeah, I get this question a lot, and I think it's like up there, I think, in, I don't know why or how this got into the ether, but I think it's one of those questions where I think founders think it's a lot more important, or just like, it's like, I don't know, like, it's like, somehow it makes a big difference, right? And my general view, right? So here's the thing. If you are in the US, right, or you're a US person, et cetera, it doesn't matter where you incorporate, like you're in the US, right? And in terms of how the laws function, usually it's by where, right, for US jurisdiction, it's by where either US customers or US investors are, right? And so let's take, like, so this is different than the BSA, this is different than money transmitter laws, let's take securities laws, right? If you're trying to take a position that you don't want to be in the US, or you're trying to evade US laws because you think your token might be a security or something, right? That token, because it's crypto, is probably going to be traded on a DEX. That token will likely then, like, undoubtedly make its way to some kind of US purchaser. So if the token is a security, then you're going to have a U.S. purchaser of this security, and therefore now U.S. securities laws attach. Or even if you did it out of Cayman Islands, BVI, Singapore, Dubai, whatever, it doesn't matter where you do it from. It doesn't matter if it's technically like registered or like legal there, right? Because at the end of the day, it still gets to U.S. users. And for you to basically then be in compliance with U.S. securities laws, you then need to either rely on some kind of like exemption under U.S. securities laws or register with the SEC, right? And so U.S. securities laws will still attach because it's by the end user slash like investor. Similar thing with the money transmitter laws, right? Like if you have someone using your app, right? And it ends up going to some kind of U.S. user at the end of the day, the U.S. will have jurisdiction. And now there's more of a practical question of like, okay, well, what is the likelihood that, like, you know, the U.S. will come after me if I'm in, you know, I don't know, like Singapore, right? You know, then you might want to get into like extradition treaties, et cetera, things like that. But I found that, like, you know, most founders, like, they don't even want to go that far. I think most founders are trying to do the right thing. They're not trying to like just beat criminals and like evade U.S. law in that way, right? And so my general kind of view and advice is if you're in the U.S. anyway, there's no difference in like you might as well form a US C corp, especially because if you do want to raise any sort of like venture capital, then you know you're going to kind of increase the pool of potential investors, because a lot of investors can only invest in US C corps, specifically many times Delaware C corps. If you're not in the US, you know, and if you think that you will most likely raise from like Asian crypto investors, let's say, yeah, then like, why even form a U.S. entity? Like you're not in the U.S. and you're going to invest for, you know, raise from investors who can maybe like invest in non-U.S. entities. So like, who cares, right? Like, what's even the point of being, you know, like some kind of like Delaware C corp or something? And then, you know, I kind of run, like, the middle issue or the middle scenario here is if you're not in the U.S. and you want to raise from U.S. investors. There, I'd probably say, regardless, you should probably just form a USC Corp, just because as soon as you start, because also your equity, right? You could be like a US Singapore entity, right? But if you issue shares from that entity, and again, it goes to US investors, the US still has jurisdiction. And I mean, you'll have jurisdiction for like securities law purposes, but they'll still have US jurisdiction. So I'll say in that scenario, just form a US entity. And you know, I could be biased, I am a US lawyer, but I would say like, basically, unless you're outside of the US and raising from non-US investors, it probably doesn't make that big of a difference from a regulatory perspective if you just form a US entity.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Cool. Man, I think there's a very high knowledge per minute dropped in this past
Yeah, I know it might be very, you know, sorry if it's like very boring, it's like very dry, illegal stuff. We should definitely chat sometime about some more fun things, but I think it is helpful. Because frankly, I've had like three of these calls the last few days. I've been going through a lot of this. And it is very, unfortunately, like this like money transmitter stuff is very much in the weeds. And it's very fact dependent. And we're in this like major gray zone right now that, again, was a little more certain. Not completely certain, right? Because it's crypto. Nothing is certain in crypto from a legal perspective. But was a little bit more certain until kind of this last week. And now I think everyone's trying to piece together what everything means. And kind of how to move forward. And so I think, you know, as things start going forward, we might hopefully get a little more clarity as to kind of what's the best way to kind of structure these things to again not fall under the DOJ's wrath and be like an unlicensed money transmitter. But yeah. So hopefully we kind of end up getting a little bit more guidance there. And hopefully maybe, you know, the Tornado Cash and Samurai defendants end up winning in court. Yep. Fingers crossed.
100%. All right. Any other thing you want to close on? I mean, you got a wealth of knowledge. You can go all day on this stuff, but do you want to leave it here or anything you want to close on?
Yeah, I would say, generally, you know, I think sometimes, like, and I might do this sometimes, so I like do posting. I think sometimes people can be very pessimistic, and lawyers too, because, like, you know, literally my job is to like point out risk, right? But at the end of the day, you know, I'm always blown away by how people kind of end up developing very creative solutions, and moving forward. And this industry has been, I feel like left for dead, or people thought that, like, you know, there'd be some kind of legal development, but killing the industry, and it never happens. Right. At the end of the day, crypto's going to survive, crypto's going to move forward, it's going to keep growing. And, you know, we just have a few challenges in this kind of intermediary kind of zone while we're growing as an industry. But I'm pretty confident that we will get there. I think there's some pretty good developments on the legislative side, not perfect, but I think will hopefully kind of provide us clarity. And I think, you know, moving forward, you are seeing a lot more projects, success kind of like outside of the US. And I think it is creating this scenario where a lot of like US lawmakers are kind of like, okay, this is a little bit of an untenable situation. You know, yes, we care about national security, but is it also good for national security to have this alternate financial system that the US has like no buy-in? Because we just moved the entire industry outside of the US, right? That's also not good for national security. So, you know, I'm pretty optimistic about crypto long-term, even if we may have some bumps in the road. But yeah, and the other, I guess one last thing I would say is, you know, I understand, I've been a founder before, so I understand that, like, you may not have a lot of money, but it takes a lot of money to, like, develop a protocol or product if you're a startup. But I would say before you launch something, just like have a quick convo with a lawyer. It can be like 30 minutes. Like just pay for like 30 minutes to an hour. Like they don't have to do a full thorough analysis. That's always better, of course, but they can just kind of like raise some things that might, some very easy low hanging fruit that can really, you know, make sure like help you to not just like, or some like, it can help you kind of like mitigate some things with some low hanging fruit that can really kind of, I think like save the day in terms of potential government or regulatory enforcement.
Excellent. Now that's a great way to end it on somewhat of a higher note. So appreciate that. Don't fade human ingenuity. People are going to figure ways.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Be like water.
Exactly. Dope, man.
Well, thank you for this. This has been fantastic. Very timely. So thanks for coming on, my man.
Thank you for listening this far into the episode. If you found it enjoyable, please do like, subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on. YouTube does me a huge favor to like and subscribe. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain. Show me some love. I reply to every DM. And if you are a Bitcoin builder that is kind of at the forefront of building new use cases, whether it's L1, Lightning, Stacks, Rootstock, Rollups, Ordinals, BRC20, I want to talk to you. So when I'm not doing this podcast, I am the sourcing partner at the Bitcoin Frontier Fund, where we invest in Bitcoin startups at the earliest stages, give you access to whatever you need, whether it's legal, product, fundraising help, as well as capital. So love to talk to you. You can hit me up. Again, find me on Twitter, at Jake Blockchain, and shoot me a DM. I'll read everything. Love to talk to you guys. All right, peace. It's gone up. We playing the long game to the black rock chains with the racks paid off from the blockchain. Going up high octane, so we up in here like Palmer. Making big noise, big money. Go play with your kid toys. You funny, I'm counting my Bitcoin. We up and we been gone. It's gone up. Planned it out and we did this purposefully. Panning out like the kitchen currently. It's like surgery. Way it's earning me. A nurse's salary for cryptocurrency. I'm on a vacay drinking coconuts while wearing polka dots. This ain't no hocus pocus. Listen up and learn. It's gone.